Welcome to House Revenue. We're going to start with the public hearing portion of the agenda before we get back to the work session items. So I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2248, which is a bill relating to tax exemptions available to qualified business firms in enterprise zones. Bill Scott and Art Fish.
2248?
Yes.
Okay.
Is that what I said?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Scott. I'm the director of the Oregon Economic Development Department. The bill before you is the engrossed House Bill 2248, originated as a department-requested bill that makes modifications to our enterprise zone program, and as originally conceived, the bill was essentially a fine-tuning of the what we call the enhanced enterprise zone or the long-term enterprise zone bill that passed the last session at the request of Nucor, and makes possible a much longer enterprise zone benefit available only in chronically distressed portions of the state. In the House Commerce Committee, there have been a number of amendments to the bill as we propose them, which have added a number of additional, more substantive changes to the bill, essentially all of them designed to expand the application of the long-term exemption to situations that for the original bill was very restrictive. This would these amendments would expand its application to a number of situations that we still don't think will result in a great deal of use of this exemption, but would make it much more likely to be used and probably make it fairer in its in the different locations around the state where it could be used. The let me just briefly, I guess I would say, overview of those substantive changes, and then I've got with me Art Fish, who is our coordinator of our Enterprise Zone program, who can answer any technical questions that you have, because this can get pretty esoteric in the application of this activity. The first of all, the main original changes in the bill were to allow to slightly expand the subject matter on which the kind of investment that could qualify for an enterprise zone. And I'm on the second page of my testimony now, under kind of Roman numeral one, the 3 to 5 year property tax exemption. Essentially, the original legislation only permits what we call traded sector investments, or primarily manufacturing investments. One of the uses that we're finding a lot of demand for in rural areas today, or some demand for, is what we call call centers or customer service centers, where people are either calling out or calling in, and there's a lot of telecommunications equipment involved. This is a relatively high property tax. It's not necessarily clear under the current statute that that use qualifies for the zone, so that's the first significant clarification. There are some other technical improvements there that are essentially responses to audit findings that we had that are that are intended to clarify or simplify the process for the county assessors. In terms of the changes in the long-term zone, the original bill, we had two main changes. One, the original bill allowed the 15-year exemption in the case of counties with chronic low unemployment. We've added to that an exception for counties of chronic low income, since there are certain counties, and I believe the main one affected by this is Tillamook County, where they have a very distressed situation, but their unemployment rate is not nearly as high as some other places, but their income has dropped dramatically in the last few years. The other change is essentially to make the benefit more flexible for the local government, so they don't have to give the whole 15 years. They can negotiate anything up to 15 years. And by and large, the effort in these things is to maximize the local control that's involved. Those were really the changes that were originally in the bill. Let me walk through the fairly significant policy changes in the amendments, and these are on the third page of my testimony, 1, 2, 3, 4, and the department supports all of these amendments. We're very comfortable that they're carrying out the intent of the original bill. First of all, a further expansion of the uses to include essentially corporate headquarters as well as manufacturing facilities, so that even though the use is administrative in nature, that would qualify. That was at the request of the Portland Development Commission. The second policy change was to add a further eligibility option in addition to unemployment and chronic low income, which is long-term population decline, and essentially the beneficiary of that change is Sherman County. The third amendments, which are probably the most significant here, were requested by Representative Simmons. And as originally written, the long-term enterprise zone exemption was only available for a facility in which there was an investment of at least $50 million and 100 jobs. What this does is essentially make that a sliding limit based on areas with lower population density or greater distance from an interstate highway, then the thresholds go down. And I think that really makes this a usable tool in Eastern Oregon, whereas previously we felt it was very unlikely for this size of investment to be made there because of the relatively lower pools of workers that are available in Eastern Oregon. And then finally, the fourth amendment is to allow a single company to aggregate investments that would be in two different price zones and in order to meet the $50 million limit. And this was really requested. It makes perfect sense to us, but it was requested essentially in order to qualify a potential investment that Roseburg Forest Products intends to make in Coosa that would be, or may make in Coosa that would be complementary to its large laminated veneer lumber facility that it just announced in Riddle, and the Riddle facility qualifies for the long-term benefit on its own. The investment in Spruce Bay would be smaller, but this amendment would make it possible to aggregate the two. We think there are potentially other situations where that aggregation would also make it possible attract additional investment. We're concerned that this particular facility may locate in California if we don't find a way to make this benefit available. Those are the amendments. Essentially, the overall thrust of all the department's legislation this session is to carry out the recommendations of the Interim Work Group on Economic and Community Development, which, if you'll recall, the primary one is to shift our focus more strongly to rural and distressed communities. All the amendments to this bill essentially are designed to do that and to make it easier for distressed communities in rural Oregon to attract industrial investment.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Looking at the revenue impact, and whether this is for you or whether for staff, the last statement, on the back of the page, there seems to be some uncertainty, but then changes could have substantial but as yet undetermined impact. Anybody have any sense as to how to quantify that yet? Are we talking, how many zeros?
Yeah. Well, like I said on Saturday, I think it would be good to at least be able to get the number of businesses anyway that they think are potential candidates that could fall into, you know, this exemption now that we're going to make some of these changes. And so I think they're alluding to some of them. He talked about the Coos Bay, when you have two facilities now that are going to be allowed to be summed, aggregated together in order to meet that minimum investment requirement. And that's going to cause a few, you know, companies to come in. And I'm sure, you know, if we get a chance to talk, we should be able to get from them a few businesses. We just haven't had a chance to do that yet.
I'd be curious to know. I like the policy direction. I'm just curious to know what the revenue impact is.
Madam Chair, Representative Shetterly, the two ways that there can be a revenue impact from the expanded enterprise zone, first of all, any local property tax break has some impact if it eliminates local school taxes in terms of the state revenue implications of that. The other is the income tax exemption that the expanded zone gives the governor the authority to allow. I don't know, Art, do we have an estimate of what the Coos Bay facility would do or a generic estimate of revenue impact from us?
For the record, my name is Art Fish, Oregon Economic Development Department, Representative Shetterly, members of the committee. No, we don't have, as far as I know, a real analysis of the Coos Bay facility. We've done an analysis of the effects of the Roseburg proposal in Riddle, and the Coos Bay one is sort of one that we have some basic parameters for in terms of what the expected size and so forth are. And if they go forward with it, you know, it would have some of these impacts, but we could certainly look at the, try to model it a little further. Otherwise, in terms of investments that would be triggered in any, you know, predictable way by these changes, we really don't have many ideas in mind. It's all sort of, you know, what a lot of people would hope would happen.
Do you have the numbers on Riddle?
The numbers on Riddle, no, I don't have those. For the local analysis.
Right. I think our expectation is that we might have at most a handful in a biennium of investments that would qualify for this, and that I suppose you could imagine getting up to where at any given time you were running maybe one to two dozen long-term exemptions that would be on the books at the same time.
Statewide.
We could provide a kind of a, just a hypothetical
model
that so that you'd have some bigger than a bread box kind of an idea.
Madam Chair.
Representative Merkley.
In one of your points here, you note that you're proposing changes, and I'm trying to refine the paragraph, and that there is an attached chart that lays those changes out. I don't see that attached, and do other members of the committee have that chart?
Representative Merkley, members of the committee, are you referring to the reddish line-by-line explanation?
Were you referring to my testimony?
I was referring to statement that there's changes in the long-term rural tax incentives that are laid out in a chart. Now I'm having trouble refining the statement, but well, I guess it boils down to what are the changes in the long-term rural tax incentives that I think relate to either the number of hires or the amount of money that has to be invested?
That would be the, this is the reference.
No, I found it here.
Number three, yes.
Representative Merkley, members of the committee, you'll find the charts they referred to there, one on the back of the line-by-line explanation of the entire Aid and Growth bill. This is a chart on the last back of it that summarizes the changes pursuant to what was proposed amendment HB 2248-6. Which emanated through request by Representative Simmons. And that just gives you a thumbnail sketch of exactly how things would be modified across the top based on either issues of location relative to Interstate 5 or by virtue of the relatively low population of the county in which the facility might be located. For a more detailed view on what that means in particular counties today, you'll find a sort of a legal size chart in your packet there, which I have. And this lays out by county specific information about based on sort of the current state of population or other factors that go into these sort of sliding scales or variable adjustments. Exactly what the particular thresholds would be in these given counties, both on the first page in terms of the counties currently eligible under the law of chronic unemployment, and then on the second page, the counties that the bill is introduced would add to the mix in terms of eligibility based on low income.
Any further questions for Representative Merkley? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Scott, could you explain the rationale about these call centers and the requirement that 90% of the calls be from outside the area codes that they're located in? There seems to be a little bit of a conflict between the description that we have in the summary and what I'm now seeing in the bill. But our description says that 90% of the customers have to be outside of the state. Bill actually says 90% have to be outside the area code of the business, which seems a little bit unclear. The business could be located in an area code, and we've now got a lot of different area codes, increasingly in Oregon.
Well, that's a good point, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum. I'll give you the rationale, but I'll ask Art to speak to specifics. I think the reason for wanting the calls to be from outside of something is that in general the philosophy of the enterprise zone is to give the benefit to businesses that in effect are bringing new wealth into Oregon or exporting services or goods rather than giving tax relief to people to facilities whose main purpose is to exploit the market within Oregon. So that would be the reason for that kind of a restriction. I guess I wasn't aware of the discrepancy that you mentioned. And Art, can you speak to that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee. The language in the bill has always referred to the area code, and so I guess the discrepancy is just in the prepared remarks, sort of thinking in terms of the state. But the idea is simply to create, in allowing call centers that are engaged in retail and financial services, and again, some call centers that are engaged in certain things, that where they're serving businesses and doing some kinds of technical support, are eligible under the current laws. However, these retail or financial activities are specifically ineligible. This would create an exception for the call center, and what the proviso about a certain geographical service beyond the local area tries to do is ensure that in a way that hopefully is not a verification challenge, can be fairly easily judged, that there is no competition being subsidized vis-a-vis sort of local economic activities. And so the area code is a fairly, given that these are based on telephone activities, one that should be fairly well to fairly easily judged in terms of a company that's basically serving a large part of the country. And that, you know, so the amount that they're doing within the 541 or the 503 area code, and we basically stick with the physical area codes as opposed to these, you know, sort of new ones that are going to be added within the existing geographical area code.
Follow up.
Go ahead. Thanks.
But it still seems like if what you're trying to prevent is competition with a business operating in the enterprise zone, it's an odd way of going about that because, you know, if it's a clothing manufacturer that's located somewhere else and there aren't any clothing manufacturers in that area, what difference does it make where their calls are coming from?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the theory, really it's a whole theory of kind of segregating traded sector industries, which we do in many of our programs and activities, is really involves the relationship between the producer and the consumer, and what we mainly support is businesses that are producing for consumers outside Oregon, as exporting businesses, if you will, from a state point of view. And the obviously most people that produce in Oregon or export also have some customers in Oregon. But Oregon is a small enough consumer market that if you're a major producer, you're not likely to have a lot of customers here. The rationale here, I think, is simply to provide some kind of a test so that if the purpose of the call center was, for instance, if somebody wanted to put one in the Portland Enterprise Zone in order to telemarket to Portland customers, that we would not treat that as an eligible activity. I think that's really the goal of it. I think from a logical point of view, it may be that we should have said outside the state, you know, anyway, but I'm not sure that would be likely to be a meaningful difference in real practice.
A final question, Madam Chair. Mr. Scott, is it likely that these kinds of jobs are going to meet the wage threshold that we require? Aren't these fairly low-wage jobs?
The wages, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, on call centers vary some. When we have the wage level, it usually is a combination of benefits and salary. And in the major call centers that we have experienced in rural Oregon to date, typically they have ended up with salary and benefit packages that are significantly above average for those communities. Whether in practice they will meet the somewhat higher thresholds in this bill is question mark.
Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I would just expand on Mr. Scott's remarks by just noting here we're modifying the existing long-standing 3 to 5 year property tax exemption, which has specific limitations in terms of activity, specifically retail and finance and all these things that are non-traded sector potentially and sort of locally competitive types of activities are specifically excluded. With the long-term benefits, the main method there of sort of focusing on types of businesses is done by those thresholds that are to be modified to some degree in the bill so that it's very large investments, potentially retail, but, you know, if you look at the size of the investments and the pay scales involved, not likely. With regards to the short-term benefits, you know, the 3 year does not carry us explicit wage or compensation benefits. The extension of that to 4 or 5 years in total of property tax rate does. And in some cases, these call centers might pay that actually 1.5 times the county wage. Some counties in the state have a fairly low average annual wage. But if they don't, they, you know, they would be eligible for the 3 year benefit, as a lot of companies, manufacturing and otherwise, are and do use it already.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I just want to clarify. In your testimony, you discussed these 4 numbers. These are already in the bill. You've made the changes in the Commerce. I'm on Commerce. I wasn't there when we were voting on it. I guess the issue I want to raise with y'all is I'm real concerned we don't have the revenue numbers attached to this bill. And I'm real concerned that we're very late in the session and that urgency time is really critical or this bill will die because I can't move without knowing these numbers. And I really want to urge you, in terms of our timing and calendaring, you have a couple of days here to pull those numbers together and bring them back in. Just wanted you to know that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen, thank you. Yes, we can turn them around quickly.
Because you can get them to Elizabeth very quickly.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, we're going to wait for the revenue impact before we go into work session on this. And is anyone else here to speak on this bill, 2248? Not. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2248. And I want to open the...
Okay.
Open public hearing on House Bill 3595. This is an amendment, isn't there? Not Ed. No. There's supposed to be a new amendment.
Nope, not yet. Are you taking witnesses?
Yeah, there's no one signed up to speak on 3595. Is anybody here who wanted to speak on it?
There's several. I see Marty Scafori and Swell.
Okay. Marty, do you want to come up too?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland, and with me is Terry Thrasher with the City Attorney's Office. I want to speak to House Bill 3595. This bill was introduced to correct what is believed to be the unfair imposition of the City of Portland's business license tax on lawyers whose principal practice is not in the city. The sponsor of this legislation believes that lawyers located outside the city limits are forced to pay the city's business license tax because they must conduct part of their practice at the Multnomah County Courthouse, which is located in downtown Portland. Therefore, it is believed that Portland is taking advantage of the circumstances of a location of a public building to exact an unfair tax. Portland would like to respond with the following facts. First, here is how it works. Portland's business license tax, in its more or less current form, has been in existence for 26 years. It is a revenue-based, not regulation-based license. To our knowledge, it is unique in Oregon. Most cities which impose business licenses base the tax on the number of employees or amount of square footage of space of an employee within the city limits. Portland long ago chose a different route. Portland's business license tax is based on annual net adjusted income earned in the city of Portland by an employer, not an employee. Earnings may be apportioned. A business located in Portland, which derives income outside the city, may apportion its income accordingly. A business located outside Portland, which derives income within the city, may likewise apportion its income. A sole proprietorship must gross at least $25,000 a year in Portland to be subject to the business license tax at all. The city's minimum tax is $100 per year. Generally, the tax is based on 2.2% of net adjusted income earned within the city. Putting this in context, a sole proprietorship would have to report net adjusted income, and that is net adjusted income earned in Portland, of more than $5,000 a year to pay more than the minimum $100. Portland's tax is based on well-established and accepted tax theory, that is, that earnings attributable to a jurisdiction may be taxed by that jurisdiction, and earnings attributable to multiple jurisdictions may be apportioned among those jurisdictions proportionately to where income has been derived. The state of Oregon practices this theory. For example, income earned by non-residents who work in Oregon is taxed by the state. Income of multi-state corporations, which is attributed to activity in Oregon, is taxed by the state. Other states practice this theory as well. For example, if an Oregon firm earns income by practicing in California, the state and perhaps the city in which the income has been earned will impose a tax. It has been proposed that practicing attorneys have no choice but to come downtown to Portland because that's where the courthouse is. It has also been proposed that these practicing attorneys are uniquely burdened by Portland's business income tax because Portland is taking unfair advantage of a physical location of a public building. However, please consider the following. House Bill 3595 would excuse any lawyer physically located outside Portland from paying the city's business license tax for earnings within the city. The premise is that these lawyers are forced to pay the tax because the courthouse is located within the city limits. However, the practices of many lawyers, whether in or outside the city, never involve having to go to the Multnomah County courthouse at all. The licensee has been designed to achieve a level playing field between those who are located in Portland and those who are not, but who are doing business in Portland. Taxing only those who are located in Portland would create an unfair competitive advantage for those who choose to locate outside the city limits, but who earn their incomes in Portland. Lawyers are not the only professionals who must come to a public building within the city in order to do business. For example, architects, plumbers, electricians, remodelers with Portland clients must come to city buildings to obtain plan reviews, building permits, and the like. Finally, the Multnomah County Courthouse is not the only such publicly funded facility located in Portland where people must come in order to do business. For example, the Oregon Convention Center, the Multnomah County Expo Center, Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, OHSU, and others are served by employers who may or may not be located in Portland and who pay Portland's business license tax. In a recent similar case, the courts have ruled that a sufficient nexus existed for the city to impose this license tax on an out-of-city attorney. The court found that the plaintiff purposefully came into the city to earn income and received the benefits of the taxing authority that enabled him to conduct his business. Those benefits included police and fire protection and the maintenance of an orderly civil society in which to conduct one's affairs. Finally, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this bill is poorly drafted and could result in unintended consequences and raises questions of equal protection. The bill as written would excuse any attorney whose principal practice is located outside the limits of a taxing authority from paying a tax. Thus, a large Seattle-based law firm with a satellite smaller office of perhaps 200 attorneys or so located in downtown Portland could avoid paying not only the city's business license tax, but also property taxes, local gas taxes, lodging taxes, and any other county or city imposed taxes. The bill as written could excuse only attorneys, even though, as I have said, other classes of employers could argue similarly situated circumstances. The bill as written could open a Pandora's box of challenges to the city's business income tax of legislative unraveling of a uniquely crafted local privilege tax. And finally, Mr. Chairman and members, the bill as written could result in a substantial revenue loss to the city of Portland.
Thank you. I have no comments. I'm here to answer questions if you have.
Okay. Very
good. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. The last time we heard this bill, the chair suggested that next time it came up that the League provide some information about other cities' business license taxes. And what you have this morning is the most recent data that we could find that came from a survey the U.S. Department of the Census did in 1995, where you can clearly see that Portland's revenue raise is larger than that of other cities, but that many cities have a business license tax and that they receive revenue from it. It's not clear to me exactly how much is business license and how much would be lumped in from things like transient lodging taxes. This form is as is shown on the sheet there, the heading of it. But judging from the cities and their size, I'm guessing some of them included transient lodging taxes here. I also gave you a couple of ordinances from Tigard and Beaverton to give you a sense of how other cities approach this. And as Ms. Corey pointed out, it appears that Portland is unique among cities, but not unique when you compare it to the state of Oregon and how the state of Oregon collects taxes from companies within and outside of Oregon and how it collects payroll taxes from employees who may work in the state but live outside the state. We think that the fundamental issue here from the League's perspective is the preemption of a local revenue authority and the larger question of how local revenues are raised and how the cost of services should be fairly apportioned among the users of the services. That issue is more critical now, I think, that property taxes are a smaller percentage of local revenues, and yet the demands for services and the cost of services continue to grow. We're also concerned that this bill, which appears to be simple on its face and involve a small group of taxpayers, could have significant effects in the long run because the city and any city who is preempted from raising revenues will still have to provide services, will still have to raise funds to provide the cost of those services, and including the demands of services from those who are no longer paying the tax. Presumably, in the long run, if that trend were to continue, if more taxpayers were to be exempted from the business license tax or any other taxes, one would assume that those who are still in the city will be paying a higher level of tax, and I wonder what impact that will have on the central city and on the desirability of Portland or any other city as a place for commerce, and then what effect it has on the cities and the counties outside of the central city. I also think Mr. Gaffori is right, and if this exemption were to take place this session, you would see a session of others next session from those who agreed that not just lawyers, it should be us, too, and it's the us, too, that is a significant problem. So, again, I would urge you not to preempt any city's local revenue raising authority. Okay, happy to answer.
Okay, thank you all. Any questions from the committee? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Isn't there a significant difference here between the situation with an attorney who has to come to Portland to file papers, to appear in court, and so forth, and the analogy that you are using of other businesses that might be located outside of the city but come into the city to do business with customers on a voluntary basis. In the case of an attorney, it's really not voluntary. It's critical to his practice that he come to Portland to come to the courthouse. So I don't understand the analogy that's being used here when you talk about other businesses that come into the city seeking to do business.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, our view is that, and the courts have upheld this, that lawyers are business people like anyone else, number one, and that they don't deserve any particular special exemption. And the question you raise is a good one, but we think we have a response. And the response is that lawyers who are outside the city, I mean, if we want to talk about voluntary decisions, a lawyer who is outside the city can make two or three different decisions. One is he can decide not to be a litigator. He or she can decide not to be a litigator. So that person never goes to the courthouse, and most lawyers aren't litigators. We think the notion that trial lawyers have special rights to special tax exemptions raises serious concerns of equity for all lawyers or all business people, number one. Number two, certainly a lawyer who takes on a client who is going to be filing cases in Portland has to come to Portland, but a business person who decides, as one of my colleagues hired an Oregon City plumber to do his plumbing work because the Oregon City plumber appeared to be the best bid and do the highest quality work, that plumber had to spend time doing all the kinds of stuff at public buildings that contractors do. Now, that plumber could have said, I don't want to do business in Portland because I'm going to have to pay this business tax. Similarly, a lawyer could say, as a client comes in, I want to file a lawsuit in Portland, and the lawyer says, well, I'm not a trial lawyer, number one, or I don't want to go to Portland because I may have to pay $100 in a business license fee. So certainly once you make the choice to take on a client that wants you to file a lawsuit in Portland, if you aren't going to be able to file it in the outlying area, for instance, Rutland now having part of the Multnomah County Court out there, and a lot of cases can be filed there and whatnot. Once you make that choice, you are coming to Portland, but the fact of the matter is lawyers can make a choice not to take that client, just like the Oregon City plumber could decide, no, I don't do business in Portland because I might have to pay a tax there. But if you do business in Portland and you choose to do business in Portland and you take advantage of the city services, then we think it is only fair that you should pay for the services that you're using. Go ahead.
But isn't there an essential distinction here, namely that Portland is taking advantage of the fact that the courthouse, the Multnomah County Courthouse, is contained in the city of Portland, not contained in Gresham? To use an analogy, in Washington County, if Hillsborough had an income tax, it could be in a position to do what Portland's doing and pass an income tax upon attorneys who are in Beaverton that Beaverton could not pass on to attorneys that are in Hillsborough by the simple fact that the attorney, as an integral part of his or her practice, has to go to the courthouse from time to time to file papers and do various things that are critical to their job. That doesn't exist in the case of the plumber. It's not the same analogy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, there are factual distinctions, but we think that there is no significant equitable difference because of the reason I pointed out. Not all lawyers have to go to court. A lot of lawyers try not to go to court. And in fact, there are other, if we start making these distinctions, there are other public facilities in Portland that people have to come to. Shall we tell export importers, because the port of Portland is located in Portland, that if you want to be in the export import business, you're going to have to come to the port? So you don't have to pay the city of Portland's tax because as an integral part of your export-import business, you have to come to Portland because that's where the Port of Portland facilities are. Fairly or unfairly, the city of Portland is a commercial center. And when people do business there, we are able to maintain our services because we charge them for the services that they use. And I understand the distinction you're making between a lawyer going to a court and an export importer, except that's sort of true. It just happens to be a court, I guess we would say. It just happens to be the Port of Portland. And the export-importer could argue, as a representative of the League has suggested, the export-importer next session is going to come in and argue, well, gee, if the Port of Portland facilities were in some other city, I wouldn't have to pay the Port of City of Portland, but I have to go to Portland every week to do my business. I don't want to pay the tax. And the one thing that seems almost unique from the city's tax is how even-handed and fair it is. If we start opening little loopholes here, here's a lawyer, here's a plumber, here's an export-importer, it's going to start looking like a federal income tax. And if there's anything we know about the federal income tax, it's just a tax of special pleading. The one thing that we've done is said anybody that does business in this city, whether you're a lawyer or a plumber or an electrician or an export-importer, you pay the tax on the income you earn in our city. And we are concerned if we start opening up these little, if I can be so crude, little loopholes for individual kinds of employers or business people. And with all due respect, I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for 20 years, and I think that lawyers ought to play by the rules that everyone else does.
Just an observation. The law is about making distinctions from various fact situations. And you say play by the rules of everybody else. The facts are different. The attorney who's in Gresham, or even the who has to come down to the Multnomah County Courthouse in Portland, is in a different situation than the plumber. So, I mean, the law is about making distinctions in certain fact situations.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Britt, as you probably know, the City of Portland was sued by another lawyer who was similarly situated to the person who has asked for this bill. And the court found, in fact, for the city and found that there was a nexus in spite of the fact that the person was theoretically required to come to the city and pay the tax. The court upheld the city's tax and found the nexus.
And one final comment, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gwynn. You are drawing a distinction that I understand, although with all due respect, we think the distinction is not significant enough to change the law. I guess we have, with all due respect, and I respect your right to have a different opinion, the city thinks that is not a distinction that justifies significant different tax treatment. But if you're going to make that distinction, then I would suggest that the bill should be changed to exempt only lawyers who are trial lawyers, so we know whom we're advantaging. Let's advantage the trial lawyers, the business lawyers, the real estate lawyers, all the other people that come to Portland and make a living just like the plumber, will be taxed. And trial lawyers will be given a special tax exemption. And
you're here.
And if that is the distinction we're going to draw, then, with all due respect, the city is very concerned about the fairness and equal protection implications that raises.
Further questions? Jane Merkley?
Sure. I was initially concerned about this issue of someone outside the city going and filing in the county courthouse. But I believe that there is a significant gross income test. Is it $25,000, something of this nature?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, yes, that is the phrase.
Now, if I'm located outside the city and I have a customer inside Portland and they come to my office and meet with me outside of Portland, I don't believe that counts against this income test, does it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, you are earning income in that case in your office, which is not located in the city of Portland.
Okay. So I could have a practice in which 100% of my customers are from Portland, but as long as I'm meeting with them outside of Portland, I'm never affected by this business tax?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, that is correct.
And unless I exceed this $30,000 or $25,000 threshold?
That is correct.
Okay. The next thing I found interesting was to see how much of a burden is being imposed by folks who might live outside and do business in Portland. And if someone was grossing $50,000 inside of Portland, it's my impression from the math that their annual business fee would be about $100. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, the fee is actually based on a adjusted net income. That means that after all expenses and all costs of doing business are removed from income, then the fee is applied to the remainder, and that fee is 2.2% applied to the remainder.
So if I was grossing $100,000 and I had a 5% margin, so my net is $5,000, I'd be paying a fee of slightly under or just over $100.
If that $5,000 was apportioned to earnings in the city of Portland, you would be
$100. So if I had a practice of $250,000 and $100,000 is inside Portland and I'm netting 5%, I'd be paying a $100 fee for the honor of conducting that business in Portland, that portion of the business in Portland.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, assuming your math is correct, you're quicker at doing this than I am on the stand, that would be correct.
Well, colleagues, I'd just like to point out that folks can base their entire business on customers inside Portland and not be eligible for this tax, or they can gross a huge amount inside Portland and be paying a very modest $100 tax, and I don't think there is a huge issue of fairness here. There's certainly costs in maintaining the infrastructure, and the denser the commercial center is, the more expensive that infrastructure is. There needs to be a reasonable way to collect taxes to pay for that, and that's what Portland has done.
Representative Chatterman?
Sure. I guess let me take it this way, and just in terms of the logical understanding of this. If I'm coming into town to see a client or coming to the courthouse, I drive in and I park at the parking garage across the street from the courthouse, let's say at Kitty Corner there. I pay the parking fee, I come in, I do my business in the courthouse. If I'm there over a lunch hour, I'll go have a meal. I leave the courthouse, I check out of the parking meter to the parking garage, I drive out of town and I'm done. If I'm taking my family up for the day in Portland, we come up, we park in a parking garage, we spend the day, we maybe have a meal, and when we're done, we leave the parking garage and we drive out. What activity, what's the difference in those activities in terms of what it costs the city of Portland to make those days possible for me? What's the cost related to my activities there in the city? As far as Portland, as far as the impact on Portland goes, they're the same. One's being taxed and one's not. I guess that's an issue of equal treatment that I'd like some discussion on. Just because I'm there for profit on one occasion doesn't have any impact on what it costs the city of Portland to provide the streets for my activity, to provide the streetlights and whatever other support services and infrastructure are required. So why? What justifies the tax in one case and not the tax in the others?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shirley, I'll try this one way, and then maybe the lawyers can try it another way. The tax, first of all, was not based on whether your family came with you, and we appreciate your comments and theirs if they come, but was based on creating a level playing field of earnings, based on earnings that take place within the city of Portland. So it really is blind to any ancillary activities that may occur by you while you happen to be in the city conducting business.
Well, but the reason I ask that is part of the justification is the cost to Portland to provide services and infrastructure to people doing business within the city. That was part of my question.
Right, Mr. Chairman and Representative Shetterly, I would say as I look at this, that you could draw a similar analogy, if you would, by a person who lives in Vancouver, Washington, and happens to bring his family with him or her when he or she goes to work. And the family goes and shops and plays and roller skates and whatever, and the person goes to work. And that person's income is taxed by the state of Oregon, and that activity by the state of Oregon is blind to other activities that that family might be engaged in while that family is in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shirley, I guess I would answer it if it were the one occasion, unless you had a really good day in court and made $25,000 net income in that day. It's not the one day that is the issue. It is the generation of income over the course of the year that, as my understanding, is how the law, Portland law, perceives it, as opposed to an occasional, you come into town, your family comes into town, or you come to do business on an occasional basis. It's the generation of income over the period of time. I think that's where the distinction comes, not on the one-day use kind of issue.
Well, Mr. Weil, is Mr. Weil here today? He sent a letter, and I think maybe this is kind of the central issue that we're talking about here is he's talking about your opinion that filing cases and appearing in court at the county courthouse are doing business in Portland. And is that the test that you have for doing business in Portland, filing cases and appearing in court?
Mr. Chair, that is one, that could be one form of doing business in Portland. The definition of doing business is engaged in essentially any activity for gain. And if you are coming into town on a pro bono case, it wouldn't be for gain and it wouldn't be doing business. If you come to town and you're charging somebody $200 an hour to go to court, it is doing business because you are making money. And I guess I would say the reason we make that distinction is because that's the distinction that the courts have made all the way back to the Lentz case in the early part of the century, where a lawyer also said, I'm not doing business, I'm a lawyer. And the court said, no, if you make money off of that, you are a lawyer and a business person. So, yes, that is one form of doing business. It is also another form of doing business if you come downtown and you negotiate a major settlement, or you close a real estate contract. It is the activity for gain that is doing business. And if you are going to court for gaining, that is doing business. That's correct.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up a little bit on the line of questioning that was raised by the representative from Portland.
Which one's that?
Well, that would be Representative Merkel that I refer to. The $25,000 threshold, I want to just comment on that for a minute. I guess I'd like you to walk with me through this little hypothetical. Let's have a hypothetical law firm out in East County, Dewey, Cheatham & Howe, you know, that famous law firm that you're also familiar with. And if that firm performed five trials, which it had to do at Multnomah County Courthouse, because it's tough to get the judge to come out and sit in your office to necessarily do a trial, and each of those trials lasted about a week. So five trials for a multi-member firm, which may not specialize in litigation, but may just do an occasional amount of work. But if those five trials lasted in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 days each over the course of a year, and the amount of fees that would be billed in that case, that would clearly exceed $25,000. But yet they have no choice but to go to the Multnomah County Courthouse to participate in those trials. And I guess I still am uncomfortable with the distinctions that you're raising. I think there's a significant difference when that's the only place you can go to do that kind of work. They have no choice but to go to Multnomah County if they're going to represent their clients. I guess I'm interested in your response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, I must say I can only respond as we have previously responded, which is an importer also has to come to Portland because that's where the port facilities are. If that firm wants to do litigation in Multnomah Circuit Court for its clients, yes, it must come there. Similarly, if an importer wants to engage in export and importing to Asia, the fact of the matter is you can't go to Baker City and do that. You're going to be in Portland. And so if that is a distinction that you think is significant, then I have no other way to persuade you otherwise. You think that they are lawyers and business people and that they should be treated evenly with all other business people, and we're very concerned about creating these individual loopholes simply because one profession goes to one public facility and another profession goes to another public facility. They're all coming to Portland because of the central commercial nature of Portland. And for better or worse, a community as large as Portland,
has certain commercial advantages over others, and that's why people come to it. They come to it for a variety of reasons, whether there's a courthouse there or a court facility there, or, as Ms. Kapori pointed out, a convention center. Or if you want to be a concessionaire at the convention center, you're not going to do that in Eugene. You're going to do that in Portland. If you want to be a baggage handler, you're going to do that at the Portland airport. So there are a lot of ways that we think business people come, are, quote, forced, close quote, to come to Portland. We think that they are, in fact, advantaged by coming to Portland. They could choose not to work in Portland. And I'm, maybe Ms. Kapori has more to say on that, but if I can't persuade you, I can't persuade you. We think that it is a not an unfair burden on lawyers, and indeed we are concerned about the burden on non-lawyers if we start giving lawyers special tax breaks.
We keep hearing all the time about how, and I said this last time we heard this bill, that even little teeny actions that we take here have this terrible chilling effect on business and how awful it is, and people are going to run and relocate somewhere else. And I've heard you say several times today, well, they just don't have to come to Portland. They just can choose not to come to Portland. It doesn't sound like you're very receptive to business when your attitude is, oh, yeah, if that plumber doesn't like Portland, he can just choose not to come to Portland. You said that a number of times. I just wonder what kind of message you're sending to the business community who tell us if we take, a teeny little tax break away that we're sending the wrong kind of message and it'll get all the way across the Pacific and tell everybody not to come to Oregon. And I think what you're saying is, don't come to Portland.
Yeah, I respond to that, Mr. Chairman.
Kind of a rhetorical statement.
I'll give a rhetorical answer if I might.
Mm-hmm.
The business tax in Portland is examined by our business community from time to time. The business committee that was put together to examine our business tax the last time was composed of a lot of business people, including representatives from the Chamber of Commerce and representatives from the Association for Portland Progress. Nobody is more concerned about the climate for business in Portland than representatives of those two organizations, as well as others who do business in Portland. They have worked through this issue in a number of different ways and have struggled very hard to maintain a fair and equitable and, I think, in their view, a reasonably welcoming situation for business in downtown Portland. They have recommended various changes to the business license tax over time that the City Council has implemented. The business tax is really a function of both the business community and the government because we share that burden with our community. So I would have to say that we have taken the advice of the business community a number of times on how the tax is constructed, and they are reasonably comfortable with it, and so are we.
I would bet that virtually everybody who participated in that, though, had an office, a location, a storefront, an address in the city of Portland. And that's very different, I think, from somebody who doesn't, but who comes in and conducts some business within the city limits of not having any kind of a location there. It's just like property taxes. I don't pay property taxes when I drive across Multnomah County because my residence is not there. I bet you those folks have businesses there.
Thank you. I have one question I would have is we're talking about the fiscal impact, let's say limited to this bill. We're talking about this bill. Is the fiscal impact more hypothetical than real? Because I guess you're really not collecting taxes, I would assume, right now from Medford lawyers who go up and spend a week in trial at Multnomah County Courthouse or for lawyers from Dallas. I mean, I just bet you're not, because they don't know about it, for one thing, and you don't know about them. And so I'm not sure, is this bill really going to have a fiscal impact by itself on the city of Portland? I think we're identifying an issue here that probably business people from out of the city have not been aware of, and again, conversely, the city has not been aware of them. And so I doubt if there are many dollars in taxes that will not be collected as a direct consequence of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shirley, I don't see the fiscal impact. I don't have that in front of me, but I believe that we gave some information to your legislative staff
which was based on the actual accounts that we have, not a theoretical collection.
But those accounts, as I understood, that's 5.2 million for 970 accounts, so that didn't differentiate between accounts within or outside of Portland.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, that is correct. We were unable to make the distinction in the short time that we had between those accounts that were physically located in Portland and those which were not. But the 970 total accounts does include a share that are located outside of Portland, and the fiscal contribution then does include a share that is coming from outside of Portland.
Okay. I don't want to spend much more time on this bill. We've got a couple others to get to. Is anybody else in the audience who's here to speak on this bill? If not, then let me find out what the appropriate committee is regarding this bill. I imagine there's divided opinions.
Mr. Chair, I need to support local community decision-making process and would not support this bill at this particular point in time.
Yeah, I definitely support the bill. I think the city of Portland is taking unfair advantage, in this case, of attorneys who are compelled as an integral part of their practice to occasionally come down to the courthouse to conduct trials and to file paperwork and so forth. And it's a clear distinction from someone who's in business who's going out into the city of Portland and looking to do business in the city of Portland with other firms, such as my company. My company pays the tax in the city of Portland. So we go in and we solicit customers in Portland. That's a very different case than when you're taking advantage of the fact that there's a facility located there, a county facility, that is an integral part of the practice. The attorneys are from time to time almost forced to go to, and to say that, well, they don't have to go there, they don't have to engage in litigation, I think is a very, very arrogant approach to this issue.
Thank you. Another comment for Commissioner Shetterly?
Thank you. Well, you know I like the bill.
You know, Representative Williams, enthusiastic.
Yeah, that's right.
Hear, hear.
It's a little embarrassing to have a bill that does lift out attorneys from every other business or occupation that might have a similar complaint about this, and so that troubles me a little bit about just the narrowness of the bill. And also I think that Ms. Kefouri or Ms. McNamara, I forget which one, raised a good point about the Seattle law firm that has the 50 attorney practice in Portland, and so if the chair is inclined to move this today, I would at least suggest a conceptual amendment with regard to that language that might fix that. But I guess the bottom line, I think that whether we move this out today or not, we're going to end up in the same place during the interim, and that is with the discussion about this, because I can just about write the veto message today on this bill if it passes out. So I think we're making a statement perhaps if we send this out. But what I hope, whether the bill goes out or not, is that we'll end up with some discussion in the interim about what the real policy is on this and the impact statewide.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, colleagues, a lot has been made of the situation which incidental occasions occur that one needs to go to the courthouse and file. I think for at least 80% of the folks involved, the gross income test exempts them, certainly your small practice. The example we had of the person who brought this forward said, I'm not sure if he said the bulk, but he said a significant portion of his business, both on the corporate side and the individual side, is within the city of Portland. And he's in the fortunate position that if he can conduct all of that business in a degree, conducts it by phone or invites people to his office, he's not paying a cent of Portland tax. Only kicks in when you gross over $25,000 and neither meeting with Portland customers over the phone or meeting with them in your office counts against that. Portland has had the courage to resist many special exceptions over time that have been brought forward. If we start down this path of telling them where to create their exceptions, we're going to have a long path to go. I think it is worthy of discussion. There are probably a few people who are in a situation
where they had a long trial in Portland, but otherwise they didn't really conduct business in the city of Portland. We haven't had a single example of someone in that situation, a real-life person brought forward. The only person we have brought forward does conduct the bulk of their business from Portland to Portland customers. So, interesting issue, worthy of debate, should be discussed in the interim, but I think it's premature for us to make a decision on it before this committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'd point out, and as I'm sure Representative Shitterling Williams can tell you, that if you get into even relatively minor litigation that goes to a 4 or 5 day trial, it doesn't take long to hit that $25,000 threshold when it comes to attorney's fees. So in reality, there's all kinds of attorneys who are going to be subject to this tax because they're going to have income that's going to be above $25,000. And the only nexus the city of Portland has to impose this tax is the good fortune for them that the Multnomah County Courthouse is located in the city of Portland. It gives them an unfair advantage that no other city in the county has.
Anybody else? Representative Ross?
Well, I was looking at this, and I'm pretty much outnumbered here. I'm not an attorney. I don't do business in Portland. And I'm not a Portland legislator, so I'm trying to get a rural flavor.
We love you anyway.
How do we get a rural
flavor? Do you have friends that are?
No, I think business does just Portland does some business with us. We sell some lumber up there for building houses and construction. But, no, I think that I could support this bill at this point in time, and I think what the Representative Shetterly had to say certainly had some merit.
I changed my mind. We don't love you anyway.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I think this has been probably argued to death, but I would just point out that Representative Shetterly circulated an email to us that from a furniture manufacturer, and I suspect that it's the truth. We know there are an awful lot of different kinds of businesses that might have arguments to make, and I do have a problem carving out an exception for the squeaky wheel that happens to be lawyers in this case without thinking about who else they might be impacting.
Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure where to go from here. We do have an amendment that would take out the hotel-motel tax aspect of it. Dash one would clarify that it's only for the privilege of doing business within the city or county, the kind of tax we're talking about. And Representative Shetterly and also Witt has some language about clarifying that principal issue and basically saying that unless somebody has an office location in the city, that it would be excluded. I think what we'll do is close the public hearing, and we'll work on this a little bit longer, and we might bring it back again. But at the very least, I think Portland should put up some signs saying warning may cost you money to come in here and do business or something else. Put up right next to the photo radar sign.
Mr. Chair. Well, on that, I think it is a cautionary note. I think this is something that has been a little, I won't say dirty little secret, but a little secret, again, for a lot of us out-of-towners, looking at my the email that I did circulate that has, I think, now gained some currency statewide. I want to remark that this was an unsolicited email from Mr. Blackledge that came in, I think, the day after we heard this bill. And what I still cannot figure out is, he says he was writing this from somewhere in the East. He was on business. Are we on the Internet?
Yes, we are.
He must have picked this up on the Internet and the email. So, hello, Mr. Blackledge. I think it's remarkable. We talk about this on a Friday, and a Corvallis businessman who happens to be in the East on business emails me on Saturday to tell me that, hey, you're onto something here. We need to look at this. So I guess the word is out, and I think Portland does have an issue to deal with here, because if the answer to this is, that's fine, I'll quit going into town to do my business so that I don't have to pay that tax, that is going to have some, perverse consequences that Portland would not want to to encourage. So somebody's got to work this out because the word is out now that you go into Portland to do business and you cross that threshold and you're going to get hit with a tax.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Lynn,
perhaps we could recommend that the city of Portland meet with Senator Lynn to work on a new sign.
Oh, Ben. Okay, close public hearing on House Bill 3595. I'm now going to open a work session on House Bill 2495. Ed, do you have some amendments to this bill and revenue impact?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We have both the dash A3 amendments, which lower the income cap for eligibility to claim the credit from $60,000 to $50,000, and move the effective date out from 1999 tax year to 2000 tax year. It also removes the carry forward provision for unused portions of the credit.
Okay. And the revenue impact is thereby reduced also.
That is correct.
Well, Chair moves adoption of the dash A3 amendments to House Bill 2495. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair moves House Bill 2495 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
Do we have any sense of our total balance budget picture at this point in time?
In terms of the bills that we've passed?
Bills we've passed, where we're going to go, how we're going to pay for little things like K-12 education. I hate sounding like a broken record here, but I guess I'm still kind of confused about what we're doing.
Well, we're doing all these things one piece at a time, and yes, there's a way that they all come together, I assume, at the end.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Rasmussen continues.
This is one of these things in our process that's driving me crazy. I think that the concept is a worthy concept. I'm finding that, and Jill and I know the total picture, voting on one thing at a time, it's not something I can continue to do, and I will reluctantly be voting against this bill, because not due to the policy issues, but due to the larger picture of how we are going to get a balanced budget out of this process.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would point out there was an interesting article in the Oregonian this morning that talked about the Revenue Committee, both in the House and the Senate. And I think what it showed was that in the House we have been very, very restrained in terms of tax breaks that we have given, and that we have targeted the great bulk of our tax breaks to people truly in need, such as disabled property owners, such as families, low and middle income families that are adopting children. I think this bill is another excellent piece of legislation that this committee, I think, has a good opportunity to adopt here. And what we're doing is we're recognizing that there are certain taxpayers and families that have very, very difficult situations. And what we're doing is providing some very modest relief to them to help them cope with a very, very critical struggle they have in their life in terms of caring for members of their family and household that require constant care. So I think this is excellent legislation. I'm a little bit disappointed in the amendments, Mr. Chairman, but if you think they were necessary at this point, I'm happy to support them. I think this is an excellent piece of legislation. It goes to people that truly are deserving of some assistance. And I think that this committee would do well to pass this measure and to do what we can to provide this relief to these taxpayers.
Well, I certainly would have preferred the original version of the bill, but again, as your comments indicates, we are trying on this side of the chamber to be very responsible in the amounts of dollars that we are including in various tax credits. So that's why I felt that it was necessary to reduce the impact.
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner Shetterman?
I'll support this. I think I have the same reservations that the Representative Rasmussen expressed. But I guess my sense is that at this point, a vote to put this forward, it is a House bill, keeps it alive, puts it in the hopper, and if the legislature comes together with the forecast on Friday and the work that's going to begin in earnest after that, I hope this will be in the Senate and will still be in the mix of things to either survive or not survive in the final analysis. And there's the governor's office after that. So I'm happy to vote to get this out, keep it moving anyway, and leave it on the table for things to be looked at when the final budget picture, in fact, does come together. It will still be moving through the process, so this is not a final action on it.
I'm happy to hear that you're working on it in earnest. I don't know if earnest has a business income tax in that. You better be careful.
I don't go there very often.
any other discussion? Please call the roll.
So three's in.
Are we already adopted that three, and I know the bill.
With your
approval. Excuse.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
No.
Representative Satterley?
Aye.
Representative Wells?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen?
No.
Mr. Robert?
Aye. House Bill 2495 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2495, and open the work session on House Bill 3344, so we can talk a little bit more about late mail tables.
Wait, what question?
That's a good work session.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, also, we do 2082 at the same time.
Sure.
Yeah, also open a work session on House 2082. Dick, where did we leave off last on whichever one of these bills?
We've sort of concluded, at least to a certain point, the discussion on 2082 and have begun the discussion on 3344.
Right.
We started that discussion by going through the amendments, the pile of amendments that I had potentially prepared.
We got through
16. And we're looking at 17. Now, I need to back up because I omitted portions of the dash 18 amendments.
Dash 18.
I took them out of order, if you recall, but
you had them in order and you destroyed my order.
I tried to get the ones that were related.
You linked 18 to 13.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The dash 13 as well as the dash 18 deal with the question of adjustments should the revenues not match up to what's expected in terms of the design, essentially, of the tax structure. And the dash 13 simply changed the reporting dates that were involved in that adjustment procedure because realistically ODOT could not meet the October and April dates, so it moved them back to November and May. The dash 18 amendments offer an alternative method which requires ODOT to again make an estimate and then compare actuals for the period July 1, 2000 through January 2001. And then should those not be sufficient to raise from the heavy vehicles their cost responsibility share, and it requires the governor to analyze that to decide what changes should take place in both, in either registration fees, the diesel tax, both, to move them into cost responsibility, and then come back, not change the rate, come back with a recommendation to the legislature.
Okay.
At the bottom of that page, section 82, is rather significant, and I'm not really ready to address that, but you can ask ODOT to address that if you want. This is the question of whether or not, the question that we asked them before, can you implement this tax by January 1? Mm-hmm. And they're sort of saying now, yes, we can, but we can probably do it a whole lot better if you make it July 1. So those amendments at the bottom would change the effective date for the tax rate changes and the movement to a diesel fuel tax to July 1 of 2000.
Okay.
That's where I omitted.
Okay. Actually, before we get into the rest of the amendments, I'd like to ask Bob Russell to just present to the committee what his concerns are about the new cost allocation study as it relates to the various rates charged to different weights of trucks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks again for the opportunity to visit with you about, this is House Bill 2082 and the weight mile tax rates that we were talking about yesterday. For the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Association. After the hearing yesterday, we actually received the weight mile tax rates for the Dash 17, I believe, amendments that would increase the gas tax by 17%. Yesterday I was talking to you about some of the shifts that were recommended by the consultant in the cost allocation study, where they were increasing the tax rates on lightweight vehicles and the extreme heavy ones, and they were at the same time reducing the tax rates on the 80,000 pounders. I was able to run some percentages on some typical truck configurations last night so I could more graphically illustrate that particular point. We're looking at a 26,000-pound pickup and delivery truck, two axles, sort of looks like your typical U-Haul truck. Under Dash 17s, that particular type of truck would get a 48% increase in their weight mile tax. A typical dump truck, which is runs at three axles, 48,000 pounds, would have a 35% increase in their tax under this proposal. The 80,000-pound five-axle truck, typically a highway truck running interstate, would get a 10.1% increase. A set of doubles at running at 92,000 pounds with six axles would get a 35% increase. And a set of triples at 105,500 pounds would get a 15.5% increase. So the point that I'm making is that he's got a curve, so to speak, with the existing weight mile tax rates. The consultant's proposal is dramatically changing that curve. And what it's doing is it's shifting the burden to the lightweight trucks and the heaviest trucks. I also passed out to you the preliminary report on another study that ODOT is doing dealing with the actual weight distance tax. As you know, today the axle weight distance tax applies only on trucks over 80,000 pounds. Its intent is to encourage us to add additional axles under heavy trucks. And the Dash 17 amendments extend that axle weight distance tax all the way down to 26,000 pounds. This particular study was analyzing the impacts of the weight distance tax. And I would like to draw your attention to the second paragraph. And the way the study was conducted, they did it two ways. They took voluminous amounts of data and tried to see if there was any change in the configurations of heavy trucks as a result of the axle weight distance tax. And then the second thing they did is they actually interviewed trucking companies to see what would motivate them to change or add additional axles under the heavy trucks. And what they have concluded, and again, this is a preliminary result, but based on the discussions with the consultant, it's unlikely that the final result is going to change significantly. It says, while approaches are quite distinct, the preliminary findings are fairly similar.
In general, the axle weight distance tax seems to have little impact on the choice to add axles for a load of a given weight. Rather, regulations, which are basically the size and weight regulations, safety, and a variety of other factors seem to outweigh the impact of the weight distance tax on this choice. So basically what they are concluding is the incentive to add additional axles does not work. What we're doing in the Dash 17s is extending a concept that doesn't work all the way down to the lightest weight trucks, further complicating the weight distance tax. What the trucking industry would suggest is that we take the existing weight distance tax tables that are in statute today and we adjust them based on the cost responsibility differential between cars and trucks, and then we increase those based on the gas tax increase that you have in the Dash 17 amendments. To do otherwise is going to raise havoc within the trucking industry, where you have such uneven increases in the taxes on different weight trucks. And you're going to have the little guys that are just essentially their tax rates are going to double. The bigger trucks are going to go up by, the largest trucks are going to go up by about a third. And the majority of trucks, and certainly those coming from out of state, are only going to see an increase of about 10%. That is going to be seriously detrimental to the trucking industry, particularly the part of the industry that is domiciled here in Oregon, the Oregon trucking businesses, because it's the Oregon trucking businesses that are operating the majority of the lightweight trucks and the heaviest trucks.
Mr. Russell, so you're basically saying you don't believe the numbers in the new highway cost allocation study and you'd rather use the old calculations.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm saying is that the trucking industry supports the adjustment that makes the differential between cars and trucks. The industry as a whole wants to pay its fair share, and we accept the results of the cost allocation study.
Does that increase or decrease the percentage that goes to trucks?
It decreases the percentage that goes to trucks. However, when you start breaking that down by 2,000-pound weight groups, we are uncomfortable with the new methodology, and that only impacts trucks. Has no impact whatsoever on cars. We are more comfortable maintaining the current relationship between the different weight classes of trucks.
But if the, again, you dispute the facts that the consultants arrived at as far as the impact of those classes of trucks on the highway, because what they're trying to do is to adjust the rates based on their analysis of impact on the highways, the true cost responsibility. So if you're saying you don't want to go there because the rates will go up, then you're really saying continue to subsidize the lighter weight trucks, even though the heavier trucks are paying a little more than their fair share.
Mr. Chairman, I am suggesting that if, in fact, the new cost allocation study is accurate to that degree, that the 80,000-pound trucks pay a little more, and the lightweight trucks and the heaviest trucks pay a little less than the results would indicate. I think the point that I'm trying to make is I don't disagree with the overall results of the cost allocation study. But when you take it down to that level of detail, it is a brand-new study, a brand-new approach, and it is not yet complete. And we are really reluctant to accept those results until we have an opportunity to look at them. And looking at the ramifications of accepting the results of a study that's not finished with a brand new approach is significant, and that's the point that I'm trying to make.
Would you and the trucking industry as a whole endorse our position as the legislature if we said, okay, we'll apply 50%? These numbers because we're not quite sure if they really are accurate, so we'll
as you just said, raise the 80,000 a little more and raise it on the lighter weight and the very heavy weight a little less? I mean, would you support us just making that as a policy choice?
Mr. Chairman, that's better than what we have proposed today. I would further suggest, and that because this is a new study and a new model, that we continue to work on it during the interim, and which I know is the intent, and that I think that we'll have much better information for you to use in 2001 when you take it down to that level of detail.
Okay. Now, if we go to 3344, there's also somewhat of a similar picture, isn't there, with lighter weight trucks paying a lot more in registration fee compared to the heavier trucks.
Mr. Chairman, I do not believe that to be correct. The variations in the registration fees based on weight, that relationship is linear, and it directly compares to the existing registration fee table. We made some adjustments in 3344 to reflect the average miles operated by different segments of the trucking industry to bring those segments into cost responsibility. When you are using a high registration fee, it is not the weights that are significant, it's the average miles. If you operate more miles, then your cost per mile comes down. If you operate less, then your cost per mile goes up. So we have made a number of adjustments. Specifically, we made some adjustments for the lightweight vehicles. Those lightweight vehicles, generally speaking, travel less miles, so we put a limit on that of 30,000 miles a year. That is cost responsible. It is my belief that 3344, based on what we know today, is more consistent with cost responsibility than what we're proposing to do in 2082 with the 8-mile tax rates.
Yes. But you would say that it would be more close to cost responsibility using the current 8-mile and not the new highway cost allocation study.
Mr. Chairman, it would cause less havoc in the trucking industry, certainly. It is possible and that the results in the cost allocation study are accurate. My concern is the study's not complete. We're taking incomplete results, accepting them as if they're gospel, and attempting to implement them. I'm asking that we not do that. We not create that havoc. We maintain the current relationships. We continue to work with the cost allocation model. If those changes are then warranted, we make that kind of an adjustment in 2001.
Questions from the committee? Dick, did you have anything you want to ask?
I think it's important to think about why the new highway cost allocation study does result in a shift from what was obtained by ODOT essentially in 1992. And I think there are two main reasons. One is, despite Mr. Russell's comments that this is not a science, I would say it's probably 90% a science. And there has been significant changes in the science of how you go about estimating cost responsibility. And what the current model does is to move away from what Mr. Russell complained about very seriously, was using a fourth power exponent in the computation of diesel. So you're talking about single axle equivalent loads. You're taking an 18,000 pound standard and you're essentially dividing the axle load by 18,000 and raising that to the fourth power to get a measure, and that's indexed then, to get a measure of the damage that the axle load is doing on the road. Now, what that does is to give extremely heavy weight to heavy axles. The result was the cost responsibility rates were low for the smaller vehicles, for the smaller weight. Now, you've moved to a new methodology, which is an adaption is the best word, of the new federal methodologies, which uses a national pavement allocation model developed by the federal government. And the EFO weights to the extent they're used, first of all, you don't just have one equation, but you've got four or five different equations in the model, which are related to the different types of pavement stress, whether it be cracking, whether it be environmental damage, and not being an engineer, I just ran out of terms. and the result of that is that it flattens out that distribution and does, in fact, give less weight to the extremely heavy loads and more weight to the lower axles. It flattens it out. It isn't as steep, nearly as steep. So the study has adopted this new methodology and therefore gets different results. Secondly, the nature of tying yourself to cost responsibility is going to result in shifts over time. And whatever disruption that causes in the industry, if you follow that, maybe you do want to, deal with longer periods of time or something to average those out. But what we had when you're looking at the 92 study was a 6-year or 4-year skip at that time, which had a lot of construction. Now you're looking at a skip, which again is for 6 years, in which there isn't a lot of construction in it. So you're trying to allocate different types of costs. So again, you end up different distribution of your allocation of your cost responsibility shares. So I think the model does come up with different answers. I think those are reasonable. And I think, that if you want to go with cost responsibility, you got to go with the state of the art. And that's the current model. Now, let me address the question of the big increase.
Let me interrupt. Just a second.
You have to go to session.
No, I just got it excused, but we'll continue until about 20 after this thing.
Bob, Mr. Russell threw out some numbers there, and I haven't seen the calculation of those, but I think what's going on is a comparison of a single rate, which was 41.5 mils, relative to a single rate, which is now in the 50s or 60s, and that represents a big increase for those vehicles at the low end of the weight scale. But what you do in the bill is to extend the axle differentials down. And part of the reason for doing that, again, there is a compliance cost to the industry, undoubtedly, but most of that has to do with changes in configuration of the vehicles. And when you move down into the lower weight categories, you're not getting those changes. The changes are occurring when you're adding trailers from 80,000 and above, basically, or at least 60,000 and above weight groups. So I'm not sure about the compliance argument cost that Mr. Russell raised the other day, but what you do get here, if you compare the 40 cents, if you look at the materials I gave you the other day and the rates that are suggested by the contractor, you compare 41.5 cents at the lowest weight there, 26 to 28,000, against 70.5 for a single unit two-axle vehicle. Big increase. Good. That's a lot of weight to be putting on a two-axle truck. It's causing a lot of damage. How can that guy avoid that? He doesn't have to use that vehicle. If he moves to a three-axle vehicle, it's down to 51.5. If he puts four axles under the vehicle, it's down to 36.5. You're already below the existing rate of 41.5. So what you're doing here is encouraging the industry to move in a direction which minimizes the damage to the roads.
Chairman, I agree with Dick, and as I mentioned earlier, I helped author the axle weight distance tax, that in theory, that would be nice, but the study that I just sent out, or just passed out to you, indicates that the theory does not work in the real world. It does not provide the inducement to add the additional axle. Second point I would like to make is what I'm asking the committee has absolutely no impact on the highway fund, has absolutely no impact on the relationship between cars and trucks. The only impact it has is within the trucking industry. And my concern is by adopting this new methodology, and we're taking a leap of faith that it's correct, which it may or may not be, and in so doing, we're going to create havoc within the trucking industry.
In making that comment, are you representing all your members, including out-of-state, in-state, everybody? Is that a consensus opinion of everyone?
Mr. Chairman, I talked to representatives of the various associations of the trucking industry last night and this morning, and they are in agreement that they are concerned about adopting the detail of the cost allocation study as it impacts trucks only until we know more about the study.
Mr. Chairman, I just have to remark that I'm not so sure that that leap of faith is any greater leap of faith than what the trucking industry is asking us to take in adopting 3344. Just a comment.
And, I think, as with most tax issues, Bob, in my experience, it's the people who pay less like it, the people who pay more don't like it. I understand what you're saying is about this increase in percent, but I was looking at, this is the chart that you gave us also, and I was looking at, what was the weight class that you cited that had a 48% increase?
The 26,000 pounders.
Okay, 26,000. Your current rate is 4.15 cents per mile. New recommended rate would be 6.25 cents per mile, for a difference of 2.1 cents per mile. So,
Mr. Chairman,
is that right?
No, it's not. Mr. Chairman, that particular chart dealt with revenue neutrality. The number that I'm quoting deals with the Dash 17 amendments to 2082,
okay,
which also includes the 6 cents. I'm not sure that Mr. Yates has provided the committee with that tax table yet, but the tax table that he provided me yesterday afternoon increases the 26,000 pounders to 8.65 cents per mile.
Okay, so that's to accommodate the new proposed increase.
Okay.
I'm sorry, we do have to go to the floor. So, we'll continue. Committee's adjourned.
Oh, come on. This is great stuff.